Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening. I'm Ellie Steele. And tonight, I wanted to talk about fate, not faith. Of course, that's a major thing, but fate. F-A-T-E. And very strange things happen with fate. Recently, I guess the reason I'm thinking about it, and I wanted to bring it up as a topic tonight, is because over the last month, actually, I've been in convalescing. I've had a bout with death, actually. I found out that I was about a day away from death, and I spent about 15 days in a hospital. Went through, I guess, six operations, I'm back. I'm feeling fine. I'm getting back to normal. But I want to thank the great doctors that put me back together there. But I wanted to, as I was laid up and staring at the hospital, this is my hospital room ceiling, and my doctor provided me with a great room with a great view, which was a blessing, since I was going to be laid up for that long. Not that I knew I was going to be laid up that long, but she happened to have the foresight to give me a great room with a view. But as I was laid up there for many, many days, you have a tendency to, I had no idea that this was going to happen to me, or that I was in that kind of condition or that problem. I went in to the emergency room thinking that I had the flu, and it turned out I had a major infection, a blood infection, and that nearly killed me. And I just had a high fever, and it was really, really quite frightening. And it took an amazing amount of effort by a number of people and surgeons to correct the situation. But I had to throw it all up to fate. I had no clue that was going to happen to me. I've never been in a hospital for that kind of time or my entire life. So, you have a tendency to feel you're invincible, and to some degree, and you can fall and you can hurt yourself. But what I'm saying is that if you go 40 or 50 or 60 years without a major health crisis, in this day and age, you feel, not only do you feel lucky, but I guess you feel somewhat invincible, which is kind of a foolish thing to think about, since your life can be snuffed out at any minute. But as I was considering the options, which there were none of, it's like at the mercy of doctors and hospital, and which I must say, were wonderful, tremendous people. I couldn't imagine having better care than I had by these physicians, surgeons, and nurses and staff. My God, it was just truly, I was blessed. And again, I felt fate, got me there and kept me there and got me here now. Because I swear to God, I had nothing to do with it. I think of how vulnerable we all are to to accident or to whim or to, you know, cosmic influences, whatever they may be. Without any real foreknowledge. And the odd thing was, is that, the very odd thing was, is that I earlier that month I had done a reading, and I saw this in the reading, and I didn't really quite understand it. I saw this tragedy, I saw this fate dealing me a blow, but I, as everybody, you just kind of think, well, what, I wonder what that could be, and I, you didn't really want to, really didn't want to dwell on the possibilities that it could be death, or it could be that close to death, but I took it as a warning. But the tarot is very powerful, very powerful, and often 99 out of 99 times can be correct. But it's fate, you know, it's fate, and dealing with fate. And before I enter into this essay by Ralph Waldo Emerson, I just wanted to say that we really do not have we really don't know. We have no control over tomorrow. And it seems like we don't have all control over today either. If you have lost so many good friends and, you know, relatives and family members, or just, you know, it was their time. And I almost lost myself. And then I found out, but as I was laying there after a third or fourth operation, kind of in a morphine haze, I realized that I had a remarkable, probably somewhat drug-induced revelation, but pain-induced as well. But I just said I had this remarkable vision of a wonderful emotional experience, but a completely fulfilled experience. Even though I was sitting there totally useless, in wretched pain, and drugged up to the hilt, coming back from recovery, and looking out my window, view to the sky, and I realized for that one moment of clarity, it seemed to be clear, that nothing meant anything but that moment. Nothing meant anything. I could not control anything except for that moment that I was in. And once I realized that, there was an emotional groundswell that just flooded my mind and my body, and I recognized and realized at that moment how, not only how precious my life was to me, and that I wanted to, you know, continue with it, regardless of the pain or regardless of whatever I was hoping I would remain alive, but also that I was so grateful for all the people made me realize that I was not only living in the moment, but I was appreciating to the fullest my life at that moment. Okay, what I had accomplished, what I was fulfilling at that moment, and all the contacts, all of the pain, all of the confusion, all of the loss, all of the fear that I had up until that moment, it vanished into a groundswell of pure love, pure fulfillment, and I can't understand exactly why that was, but anyway, I was suddenly interrupted by a doctor and a nurse as I was looking out, and I knew I had tears in my eyes, and I looked at them, and I kind of broke the trance, but they looked at me, and I saw this incredible compassion in them, and they said, "Buddy, you don't know how close you were." And I said, "Yeah, I think I do, Doc. I think I do now." As well, I just want you to know you're on the road. You know, we got a couple more operations, so you got to prepare yourself. But we'll try to get you out of this. You know, and that was the. But that was a moment when probably the second or third day I was in the hospital, and I realized how close I was to dying. That's when they told me. But I realized at that moment I had a fate was the ultimate decider. You know? And never to take for granted any a minute or a day. Or never to take for granted anything that you love or that loves you or anything that is of interest to you or anything that gives you pleasure, be it momentary or not, but allow that second or allow that minute or allow that hour to be filled. Be full, you know, and that's what I do now. I do that. I was so pleased that I was able to drive for the first time yesterday. For about a month, I hadn't been able to drive, and I got around, and then this, again. I drove around again today. I was able to do errands and get around. So I'm. Everything appears to me to be back on some kind of track. So, getting ambulatory care in the sense that I have to go and get IVs of antibiotics and all this kind of stuff. But I'm here and I'm healthy and I'm breathing and I'm talking. And I wanted to read this. I hope I have time to get through some of it tonight. From the Conduct of Life. It's called The Fate, and it's written by Ralph Waldo Emerson. And it starts off with a quick poem, and it says, "Delicate omens traced in air to the long-barred true witness bear. Birds and auguries on their wings, chanted undeceiving things. Him to beckon, him to warn, well might then the poet scorn to learn our scribe or courier, hints writ in vaster character, and on his mind at dawn of day, soft shadows of the evening lay, where the provision is allied unto the thing so signified, or say, the foresight that awaits is the same genius." Agree. during one winter a few years ago that our cities were bent on discussing the theory of the age. But an odd coincidence, four or five noted men were each reading a discourse to the citizens of Boston or New York on the spirit of the times. It so happened that the subject had the same prominence in some remarkable pamphlets and journals issued in London in the same season. To me, however, the question of the times revolved itself into a practical question of the conduct of life. How shall I live? We are incompetent to solve the times. Our geometry cannot span the huge orbits of the prevailing ideas, behold their return, and reconcile their oppositions. Excuse me. I had to listen, pull my nose here. We can only obey our own polarity. It's fine for us to speculate and elect our course if we must accept an irresistible dictation. In our first steps to gain our wishes, we come upon immovable limitations. We are fired with the hope of reform men to reform men. After many experiments, we find that we must begin earlier at school. But the boys and girls are not docile. They can make nothing of them, but we can make nothing of them. We decide that they are not of good stock. We must begin our reform earlier still, at generation. That is to say, there is fate or laws of the world. But if there is irresistible dictation, this dictation understands itself. If we must accept fate, we are not less compelled to affirm liberty. The significance of the individual, the grandeur of duty, the power of character. This is true, and that other is true. But our geometry cannot span these extreme points and reconcile them. What to do? By obeying each thought frankly, by harping or, if you will, pounding on each string, we learn at last is power. By the same obedience to other thoughts, we learn theirs, and then comes some reasonable hope of harmonizing them. We are sure that though we know not how, necessity does comport with liberty. The individual with the world, my polarity with the spirit of the times. The riddle of the age has for each a private solution. If one would study his own time, it must be by his method of taking up in turn each of the leading topics which belong to our scheme of human life, and by firmly stating all that is agreeable to experience on one, and doing the same justice to the opposing facts in the others, the true limitations will appear. Any excess of emphasis on one part would be corrected, and a just balance would be made. But let us honestly state the facts. Our America has a bad name for superficialness. Great men, great nations have not been boasters and buffoons, but perceivers of the terror of life. They have manned themselves to face it. Spartan, embodying his religion and his country, dies before his majesty without a question. The Turk, who believes his doom is written on the iron leaf in the moment when he entered the world, rushes on the enemy's saber and undivided will. The Turk, the Arab, the Persian, accepts the foredained fate. On today its steeds not to run from thy grave, the appointed and the unappointed day. On the first neither balm nor physician can save, nor thee on the second the universe slay. When the Hindu under the wheel is as firm, our Calvinists in the last generation have something of the same dignity. They felt that the weight of the universe held them down to their place. What could they do? Wise men feel that there is something which cannot be talked or voted away, a strap or belt which girds the world. The Destiny Minister General, the executive in the world, conveyance which God hath been for been before. So strong it is that thou the world had sworn. The contrary of a thing by ye or nay, yet sometime it shall fall on a day that falleth not off in a thousand year, for certainly our appetites here, be it of war or peace or hate or love, all this is ruled by the sight above. That was by Chaucer's The Knight's Tale. The Greek tragedy expressed the same sense. Whatever is fated, that will take place. The great immense mind of Jove is not to be transgressed. Savages cling to a local god of one tribe or town. The broad ethics of Jesus were quickly narrowed to village theologies, which preach an election or favoritism. And now and then an amiable parson like young Stilling or Robert Huntington believes in a Pisterian providence, which whenever a good man wants a dinner, makes that somebody shall knock at his door and leave a half dollar. But nature is no sentimentalist, does not cosset or pamper us. We must see that the world is rough and surly and will not mind drowning a man or a woman, but swallows your ship like a grain of dust. The cold inconsiderate of persons tingles your blood, benumbs your feet, freezes a man like an apple. The diseases, the elements, fortune, gravity, lightning, respect no persons. The way of providence is a little rude. The habit of snake and spider, the snap of the tiger, and others, leapers and bloody jumpers, the cackle of the bones of his prey, and the coil of the anaconda, these are in the system, and our habits are like theirs. You have just dined, and however scrupulously the slaughterhouse is concealed in the graceful distance of miles, there is complicity. Expensive races, race living at the expense of race. The planet is liable to shocks from comets, perturbations from planets, renderings from earthquakes and volcanoes, alterations of climate, precisions of equinoxes, rivers dry up by opening of the forest, the sea changes its bed, how towns and counties fall into it. At Lisbon, an earthquake killed men like flies. At Naples 3 years ago, 10,000 persons were crushed in a few minutes. The scurvy at sea, the sword of the climate in the west of Africa, at Cayenne or Panama or New Orleans, cut off men like a massacre. Our western prairie shakes with fever and ague. The cholera, the smallpox, have proved as mortal to some tribes as a frost to the crickets, which, having filled with the summer with noise, are silenced by a fall of the temperature of one night. Without uncovering what does not concern us, or counting how many species of parasites hang on a bombyx, or groping after intestinal parasites, or infusory biters, or the obscurities of alternate generation, the forms of the shark, the labrys, the jaw of the sea wolf, paved with crushing teeth, the weapons of the grampus and other warriors hidden in the sea, are hints of the ferocity in the interiors of nature. Let us not deny it up and down. Providence has a wild, rough, incalculable road to its end, and it is of no use to try to whitewash its huge, mixed instrumentalities, or to dress up that terrific benefactor in a clean shirt and white neckcloth of a student in a divinity. Will you say the disasters which threaten mankind are exceptional, and one need not lay his account for cataclysm every day? Aye, but what happens once may happen again, and so long as these strokes are not to be parried by us, they must be feared. But these shocks and ruins are less destructive to us than the stealthy power of other laws which act on us daily. An expensive ends to meet to means is fate. Organization tyrannizing over character. The menagerie or forms and power of the spine is a book of fate. The bill of the bird, the skull of the snake, determines tyrannically its limits. So is the scale of races or temperaments. So is sex. So is climate. So is the reaction of talents imprisoning the vital power in certain directions. Every spirit makes its house, but afterwards the house confines the spirit. And the gross lines are legible to the dull. The cabman is phrenologist so far. He looks in your face to see if his shilling is sure. Looks if he's going to get paid, yeah. A dome of brow denotes one thing, a pot belly another, a squint, a pug nose, mats of hair, the pigment of the epidermis, betray character. People seem stealth in their tough organization. Ask Spurzheim, ask the doctors, ask Quillette if temperaments decide nothing, or if there is anything they do not decide. Read the description in medical books of the four temperaments, and you will think you are reading your own thoughts, which you had not yet told. Find the part which black eyes and which blue eyes play severely in the company. How shall a man escape from his ancestors or draw off from his veins the black drop which he drew from his father or his mother's life? If often appears in a family as if all the qualities of the progenitors were potted in several jars, some ruling quality in each son or daughter of the house, and sometimes the unmixed temperament, the rank, unmitigated elixir, the family vice is drawn off in a separate individual and the others are proportionately relieved. We sometimes see a change of expression in our companion and say his father or his mother comes to the window of his eyes, and sometimes a remote relative. In different hours, a man represents each of several of his ancestors, as if there were seven or eight of us rolled up in each man's skin, seven or eight ancestors at least, and they constitute the variety of notes for the new piece of music, which is his life. At the corner of the street, you read the possibility of each passenger in the fragile, in the facial angle, in the complexion and the depth of his eyes. The parentage determines it. Men are what their mothers made them. You may as well ask a loom which weaves huckaback why it does not make cashmere, as expect poetry from this engineer or a chemical discovery from that jobber. Ask the digger in a ditch to explain Newton's laws. The fine organs of his brain have been pinched by overwork and squalid poverty from father to son for 100 years. When each comes forth from his mother's womb, the gate of gifts closes behind him. Let him value his hands and feet. He has but one pair. So he has but one future, and that is already predetermined in his lobes and described in that little fatty face, pig eye, and squat form. All the privilege, all the legislation of the world cannot meddle or help to make a poet or a prince of him. Jesus said, when he looketh on her, he hath committed adultery. But he is an adulterer before he has yet looked on the woman. By the superfluity of animal and a defect of thought in his constitution, who meets him or who meets her in the street seems that they are ripe for each other's victim. In certain men, digestion and sex absorb the vital force, and the stronger these are, the individual is so much weaker. The more of these drones perish, the better for the hive. If later they give birth to some superior individual with force enough to add to this animal a new aim and a new complete apparatus to work it out, all the ancestors are gladly forgotten, and most men and most women are merely one couple more. Now and then, one has a new cell or camarilla opened in his brain, an architectural or musical or philosophical knack, some stray taste or talent for flowers or chemistry or pigments or storytelling, a good hand for drawing, a good foot for dancing, an athletic frame for wide journeying, etc., which skill no wise alters rank in the scale of nature, but serves to pass the time, the life of sensation going on as before. At last, these hints and tenacities, these hints and tendencies, are fixed in one or in a succession. Each absorbs so much food and force as to become itself a new center. The new talent draws off so rapidly the vital force that not enough remains for the animal functions, hardly enough for health, so that in the second generation, if the like genius appear, the health is visibly deteriorated and the generative force impaired. People are born with a moral or with the material bias, uterine brothers with this diverging destination, and I suppose with high magnifiers, that the carpenter might come to distinguish in the embryo at the fourth day, this is a wig and that is a free soiler. determining their political but the fourth day of their gestation. It was a poetic attempt to lift that mountain of fate, to reconcile this despotism of race and liberty, which led the Hindus to say, fate is nothing but the deeds committed in a prior state of existence. I find the coincidence of the extremes of Eastern and Western speculation in the daring statements of Schelling. There is in every man a certain feeling that he has been what he is from all eternity, and by no means became such in time. To say it less sublimely, in the history of the individual is always an account of his condition, and he knows himself to be a party to his present state. A good deal of our politics is physiological. Now and then a man of wealth in the heyday of youth adopts the tenet of broadest freedom. In England, there is always some man of wealth and large connection planting himself during all his years of health on the side of progress, who as soon as he begins to die, checks his forward play, calls in his troops, and becomes conservative. That is so true. And all conservatives are such from personal defects. They have been effeminated by positions or nature, born halt and blind through luxury of their parents, and can only, like invalids, act on the defensive. But strong natures, backwoodsmen, New Hampshire giants, Napoleons, Burkes, Brahmins, Websters, are inevitable patriots until their life ebbs and their defects in gout, palsy, and money warp them. The strongest idea incarnates itself in majorities and nations, in the healthiest and in the strongest. Probability, the election goes by avoirdupois weight. And if you could weigh bodily the tonnage of any hundred of the Whig and the Democratic Party in a town on the Dearborn balance as they pass the hay scales, you could predict with certainty which party would carry it. On the whole, it would be rather the speediest way of deciding the vote to put the selectmen or the mayor and the aldermen at the hay scales. In science, we have to consider two things, power and circumstance. All we know of the egg from each successive discovery is another vesicle. And if after 500 years you get a better observer or a better glass, he finds within the last observed another. In vegetable and animal tissue, it is just alike, and all that the primary power or spasm operates is still vesicles. Yes, but the tyrannical circumstance. A vesicle in new circumstances, a vesicle lodged in darkness. Oaken thought became animal. In light, it became a plant. Lodged in the apparent animal, it suffers changes, which ends in unsheathing miraculous capability in the unaltered vesicle, and it unlocks itself to fish, bird, or quadruped head and foot, eye and claw. The circumstance of nature. Nature is what you may know. Nature is what you may do. There is much you may not. We have two things, the circumstance and the life. Once we thought positive power was all. Now we've learned that negative power or circumstances have. And nature is the tyrannous circumstances. The fixed foe, the sheathed snake, the ponderous rock like jaw necessitated activity, violent direction, the condition of a tool like the locomotive, strong enough on its track, but which can do nothing but mischief off of it, or skates, which are wings on the ice, but fetters on the ground. The book of nature is the book of fate. She turns the gigantic pages, leaf after leaf, never returning one. One leaf she lays down a floor of granite, then a thousand ages and a bed of slate, a thousand ages and a measure of coal, a thousand ages and a layer of marl and mud. Vegetable forms appear. Her first misshapen animals, zoophyte, trigolin, fish, then saurians, rude forms in which she has only blocked her future statue. Concealing under these unwieldy monsters the fine type of her coming king. The face of the planet cools and dries and races ameliorate and man is born. But then a race has lived its term, it comes no more again. And the population of the world is a conditioned population, a conditional population, not the best, but the best that could live now. And the scale of tribes and the steadiness with which victory adheres to one tribe and the defeat to another is as uniform as the supposition of strata. We know in history what weight belongs to race. We see the English, French, and Germans planting themselves at every shore and market of America and Australia and monopolizing the commerce of these countries. We like the nervous and victorious habits of our own branch of the family. We follow the steps of the Jew or the Indian or the Negro. We see how much will has been expended to extinguish the Jew in vain. And look at the unpalatable conclusions of Knox and his Fragment of Races, a rash and an unsatisfactory writer, but charged with pungent and unforgettable truths. Nature respects race and not hybrids. Every race has its own habitat. Detach a colony from the race and it deteriorates to the crab. See the shades of the picture. The German and the Irish millions, like the Negro, have a great deal of guano in their destiny. They are ferried over the Atlantic and carted over America to ditch and to drudge, to make corn cheap and then to lie down prematurely to make a spot of green grass for the on the prairie. One more faggot of these adamantine bandages is a new science of statistics. It is a rule that the most casual and extraordinary events, if the base of population is broad enough, become a matter of fixed calculation. It would not be safe to say when a captain like Bonaparte, a singer like Jenny Lind or a navigator like Bowditch would be born in Boston, but on a population of 20 or 200 million, something like accuracy may be had. 'Tis frivolous to fix pedantically the date of particular inventions. They have all been invented over and over 50 times. Man is the arc machine of which all these shifts drawn from himself are toy models. He helps himself on each emergency by copying or duplicating his own structure, just so far as the need is. 'Tis hard to find the right Homer, Zoroaster, or Manu. Harder still to find the Dupal, Cain, or Vulcan, or Cadmus, or Copernicus, or Faust, or Fulton, the indisputable inventor. And there are scores and centuries of them. The air is full of men. This kind of talent so abounds, this construction. There's a little more here left to go. I think you're getting the point. And to a large, I don't think it's probably impossible to finish this tonight because it's about a little longer than I expected it to be. But, yeah, I think you're getting the point. Faith is nature. But there's one thing. There's one thing that overwhelms or overcomes fate. And the dismal fate. You can either turn your thoughts inward negatively, or turn them outward positively, projecting that energy, that life inside you. It's kind of like when you're ready to, when you're facing death, when you're facing the possibility of it, it's right there and it's only hours away. You have one remarkable gift from the cosmic. Cosmos, and not from nature. It's not nature. It overcomes nature. It overpowers nature. That is the human will. The human will. It's what has created the greatest inventions, the greatest achievements of man. It's his will. Drive and his need to live, his desire to live. And I find that, yes, fate can beat you, can very easily beat you. But if there is a 50-50 chance of it, you have that extra in you to change the odds to 60-40, to 70-30, you know, so that you keep progressing, because your will to live gets stronger and stronger and stronger. Once you decide that you want to live, nothing can stop you. Nothing stops you. that you are here to finish something. You're here for some reason. And your job isn't done yet. And you know that. When your time is up, you know it's your time is up. And I looked at that. I looked at myself. I thought about all the things that I still wanted to do, wanted to achieve, all the people that I cared for and care for me, all the many things I want to experience before I die, many things I wanted to say, many things I wanted to teach other people, many things I wanted to know or learn before I die. That was far from over yet. And it's like I said, when, you know, though fate deals you this mighty blow, there are millions of examples of people overcoming that, overcoming these incredible odds, and receiving miracles, miracle healings, miracle inspirations. And it's happened. It's happened to me so many times that I could never, ever, ever give up. And I had a unique reading done. It was a karma reading, actually, by an astrologer named Joan Kilgren. And excellent. She's been doing it for 45 years, I believe. But there was a tremendous insight that I got from that, and in the sense that she actually understood, looking at when I was born and so on, she could see this progression and see why I came here, why I was born, why I decided to come back. First lifetime. This is my quite a number of them. But according to Joan, I came back. And I purposely came back to set out and accomplish some very ambitious goals, very difficult ones. I said I had a tremendously difficult path ahead. However, I would succeed. So I understood something that I hadn't before, because I understood karma. And then after that, I learned about doing, I learned how to do past life regression. And I was able to remember through this state at least 10 or 12 different lives I've had over the last several thousand years. And I recall the deaths. And I recall how I died in each one of them, how I lived, who I was. And I realized later that, and I realized that this life was far different than all the other lives that I had lived. In the essence that not only was I living in a time of advanced technology, and advanced science, and advanced humanity, but I was also period of time of prophecy, a time of ascension prophecy, a time of global change. Okay, and for some reason, truly unknown to me, here now and moving through this. And that is my fate. My fate was to survive. My fate was to overcome. And my fate was to learn a lesson from the suffering and the near death, and to piece that part of the puzzle of my life together. And I think I've done that, and I'm working on that. And because the one thing that this experience has taught me is to have a greater compassion. Greater compassion for my fellow men, my fellow travelers, understanding their pain, their problems, how frightening it is, it can be, and to respect their strength by overcoming that. And their wisdom and compassion. And continue to extend my hand to humanity and try to reinforce those principles which I believe are the pillars of our existence, not only as a race, but as a species, you know, as a human species. And reading things like this, and I have this particular essay. I only read about half of it. It's another 20 pages or so of it, and very difficult to. Go through it with the time restraints, but I suggest that you might want to look it up if you can go to rwe.org. Ralph Waldo Emerson is rwe.org. You can find all of his works on that website, and go under Conduct of Life and look up his essay on fate. And, I think you'll be impressed. With the next 7 minutes or so that we have remaining to show, I'm really quite certain where I want to go with this. I do know that I kind of changed my attitude. And actually for the whole year, most of the year of 2010, to a large degree, I backed away from the anger that I felt in 2008, 2009, and all the last 10 years politically and whatnot, and tried to absorb that, and tried to understand that from a higher perspective, and looking at it from a more of a metaphysical approach, and I have seen myself get so overwrought and so angry and so overwhelmed by seeing such horrors perpetrated on the planet. The lack of morality and the lack of truth and the lack of dignity by my fellow man, that I found myself becoming very angry and cynical, you know. And I still am to a large degree, but in order to be a great service, in order to be any service to mankind, to teach or to have to be positive. You have to look at things positively. You have to look at things from beyond the perspective of the day-to-day drudgery and look at life from a totally different perspective and be happy that you're alive, aware of other people's suffering, aware of what you can do to relieve your own suffering and the suffering of others, but to add to the knowledge bank of the world, or add to the knowledge. These things are all part of what I've done, what I do, what I continue to try to do. And because of that, I guess because of that, I'm here now. I'm living now. And I'm living all right. I'm not suffering. I'm not like I was. I'm on the mend. But I think I'm on the mend because of the attitude I've taken. And how that's changed me in the last few weeks. And how I look to excel every day, each day. And a good friend of mine, George Dixon, some of you may know of him, told me and continues to tell me, take it one day at a time and appreciate each day. And I do that. And I have done that for quite some time now. And it's a remarkable approach to life. And one that will always, you can't, maybe you can't win against fate, but you can definitely accept its finality if you live to the fullest each day that you live, knowing fate can take you away tomorrow. But you're only, the only satisfaction that you receive is that your life was a good one and that your work was valid and that your legacy, if you have one, is one of nobility rather than one of, you know, criminality. And it's better to be remembered for nothing than it is to be remembered as a horrid person, you know, crook or murdering thief. So, in all of our days and all of our nights, let's live to the fullest. And that is exactly what I'm doing. So, we will join me next week when we our next programs. And thank you for joining me tonight. If you like the show, tell your friends. If you didn't like the show, sorry. So, have a good night.